Hello, and welcome to Spy Hard's podcast. I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Cam the Provocateur.
And we are continuing our deep dive into 1985's spy comedy, Spies Like Us. And we have a very special guest joining us this week.
Yes, we are talking to Dave Thomas, Canadian comedy legend and actor, director, and writer, and the man who was responsible for co-writing this week's film, 1985's Spies Like Us.
But not only that, I mean, you'll see Dave Thomas in a ton of other things. I mean, he co-starred and co-directed Strange Brew with Rick Moranis, and he also directed his own spy movie, The Experts, with John Travolta in 1989, and we'll get into that, as well as a little chat about Arrested Development and tons of Spies Like Us. So I think without further ado, Cam, let's roll to the big man himself, hit that interview. Joining us now on the show, he is a Primetime Emmy Award-winning writer and actor and a director. It is the one and only legendary, Mr. Dave Thomas. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello. Lovely to be on the show, and thanks for having me.
It is a sincere pleasure to have you here. We have a lot of questions about Spies Like Us, the film we're talking about this week. I want to get into with you, but I think before we get there, I want to set the table a little bit. And this is, I'm sure, a million-dollar question. What inspired you to want to get into sort of the entertainment industry, working in comedy, that sort of getting that start in the industry? What inspired you to want to sort of go down that path all the way back then?
Well, it actually started before then. It started at college with university with Martin Short and Eugene Levy, who were friends of mine in college. And we had no drama or theater or television department at the school that I went to. And so we started our own. The student union, they charged each student a lot of dues, and so they had a lot of cash. Mm-hmm. So we were able to go to them and start our own theater company and our own film stuff. And so it was in meeting those guys, and Ivan Reitman was at the same school. So there's a bunch of us that were at that school who were doing things together. And then after the school, they were in Godspell, Marty and Eugene, before me. And I stayed to do a master's in English Lit. And then they were having far more fun, and I was having a terrible time. And so I started writing scripts for the CBC. And then... And then Second City came to Toronto, and I got into Second City. And in between those two gigs, I took a year where I wasn't able to get an acting job, a couple of years actually, and became a copywriter at McCann Erickson and wrote commercials for Coca-Cola. But the minute I found Second City, that was where I knew I wanted to be. That was, for me, the pinnacle. And I took a huge pay cut from my copywriting job to go on stage at Second City because it's what I loved. I knew it was what I really wanted to do. And I got to be in a cast with Dan Aykroyd, who I immediately paired up with and started writing things with him. And that led to a writing relationship that sort of popped on and off over the years. And prior to my partnership with Rick Moranis, I always like working with people, you know. Writing alone is, I can do it, but it's just not as much fun, especially in comedy. If you got somebody you can bounce off, it makes it much more fun.
I tend to find Cam holds me back, really, out of the two of us.
Yeah, it's true.
Unfortunately,
it's
but
true.
It's an interesting thing because I was going to mention Second City and you sort of getting connected with Dan because I think that road leads us into Spies Like Us a little bit. But
oh, definitely.
Before maybe we go down that path, the other question I had was about spy movies because that's what we talk about on the show every week is spy movies. And do you have any sort of particular love of that genre? Because of course you then directed one later on, The Experts. What was your sort of early experiences with spy movies?
Well, I've always been interested in spycraft. And then again, through my connection with Dan, because and the Spies Like Us thing, I became friendly with somebody that worked in the operations of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he was a he's retired now. His name is Gary Harrington, and he's on a show called Spy Ops. You can see him. He's featured on that show, talking about one of his undercover adventures in Afghanistan, where he was pretending to be a Canadian journalist. But I've always been into that. And when Dan and I wrote a UFO movie, and it almost got made with Phil Alden Robinson attached as director. And then the studio found out that Spielberg was doing Close Encounters, and we just got pushed aside. So then I went off to do Second City TV for a while, and Danny was doing SNL. And then Danny came back and he said, I sold something to Universal that I want to write with you. It's a spy movie, and it was for him and John Belushi to star in together. And I was already at Universal writing another movie for Joel Silver at that time. And so I said, well, I'm on this other movie right now. And then Danny said, can you get off it? And I said, oh, Joel's a maniac. He'll kill me if I try to get off it. And Danny said, well, maybe we can get the studio to do it, and then you won't be the bad guy. So he did get the studio to do it, and they moved me off the Joel Silver movie onto the Dan Aykroyd project, because Danny had the clout to be able to do that at that time. So I ended up going over to his bungalow on the lot, and Belushi was shooting Continental Divide at that time. And I remember Danny had a big trunk of books. What I loved about Dan was he was a researcher. And I loved that, because I came from an academic background. And I thought, if you can't write in an informed way, you shouldn't write. You should just, like, forget it. And so I went to Dan's office, and he had this big steamer trunk full of books. And he just said, David, we got to read every one of those books before we put pen to paper. And there were books about, you know, U.S. Sort of intercontinental ballistic missile technology, U.S. spy satellite technology, Russian mobile launch missiles, because they were really into those mobile launch missiles at the time, because they didn't have the submarine fleet that the U.S. had. So they moved their missiles around on railway tracks with mobile launchers, which is we used in the film. And I read a bunch of those books. And before we started writing, I said to Dan, you know, we should do this. Like, this should be like a kind of modern Man Who Would Be King. If we have that in our mind as our model. So we did. And then just as we finished, I had to go back to SCTV and do some more of that. And he was doing Blues Brothers, I think. And then John Belushi died before we could do. And so the project went into turnaround, because it was for John and Danny. And I didn't hear about it for a couple of years. And then I got a call from Dan, and he said, Dave, I think I got this resurrected at Warner Brothers, but Warner's wants these two guys to do a joke pass on it. And I said, oh, no, you're not going to do that, are you? And he said, it's the only way I can get it made. I said, all right, well, you came to me with it, so it's your call. You do what you want. And so it was Bablu, Lowell Ganz and Bablu Mandel did a joke pass. And Danny said to me, David, if you arbitrate they won't get a screen credit, and they are not going to do it unless they can get a screen credit. This is a WGA thing. And I said, I'm not going to arbitrate. I already got way more than I deserve for the work that I did on it. So forget it, you know. So he said, I'll make sure you get story by credit. And I said, okay, that's fine. So he got it going with him and Chevy. And he attached Landis as the director. And then they offered me an acting part in it, but I was doing SCTV and I couldn't. And and then about, this is the kind of guy Danny is, about, I don't know, 3 years later, 2 years later, something like that, I get a legal letter in the mail. And it's like, uh-oh, whenever you get a legal letter, it's like, oh man, am I getting sued or what is this? So I open it up and it's from Danny's lawyers. And they say, Mr. Aykroyd has advised us that he wants to give you one of his gross adjusted points in the movie Spy Like Us. And I was like, oh, well, that's nice. And then, I don't know, about 2 months later, 3 months later, I get this big fat check from Universal for, you know, my first profit check on Spies Like Us. So, see, it pays to be a team player and drop back and take a story by credit, because then the good guys will wave their wand on you. And, you know, so we had a lot of fun writing that. And the first couple of drafts that we wrote are way more like The Man Who Would Be King. Dan had books in that steamer trunk. He had books on Central Asia, the sort of topography of the place that he thought this should be set, where the movie should be set. And you know, I familiarized myself with all of that. And then we rolled up our sleeves and started writing. And I remember we were working on the script, and Dan was sitting across from me, across the desk. We were talking about that test scene with him and Belushi, and I said, "Well, what if they cheat on the tests?" And Dan literally jumped over the desk and kissed me, and he said, "That's it." He said, every once in a while, you get an idea that is the essence of the movie. And two guys that take a CIA test and cheat to succeed on the test are, in a strange and twisted way, the perfect candidates for the job, you know. So there were some other things that happened during the writing of that. But I remember John was still alive at the time, and he was coming in on his lunch breaks from Continental Divide, and crashing and talking to us. And it was strange writing it for him and John, and then trying to imagine it for him and Chevy, because, you know, the chemistry between Dan and John was far different than the chemistry between Dan and Chevy could ever be.
Yeah.
You know, because Chevy always plays kind of outside the reality. You know what I mean? Even on SNL, where there really is no reality, at that news desk, he was always sort of 1 foot out of the reality of the show. And in a way that gives him a kind of a bulletproof invulnerability, because he's not part of it. Mm-hmm. So if this thing's a turd and it goes down, it ain't my turd. You know what I mean? But at the same time, it's got kind of a Bob Hope, Bing Crosby thing from the road movies, where they had 1 foot outside the reality of their breaking the fourth wall and things like that. So it definitely was a change in the dynamic of the script. And then I guess that's why they wanted a joke pass, you know. But Warner's at that time was joking up everything. Katzenberg and Eisner were running Paramount, and they hadn't gone to Disney yet. And they had a big influence on comedy in particular. Katzenberg had this theory that if he had three teams working on the same movie, he could mix and match the best of all three scripts. Then when you'd go to one of these movies, you'd look at it and you'd go, I don't know, it seems like three different movies kind of pasted together by some executive, which is what it was, you know? So other studio executives were doing that at the same time, including the Warner's guys. So nothing surprised me. This business has always been like that, you know? So
one thing I'd read online, and you can clarify this, you can set the record straight, was that obviously, you know, you have Belushi passes away and Chase ultimately takes the role opposite Aykroyd. But I'd read various stories that said either that Richard Pryor at one point was seen as a potential co-star, and also that at one point it was potentially going to be a project for you and Rick Moranis to star in.
I never heard that.
Interesting. Okay, the record is being set straight there.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't surprise me that that Danny or Warner Brothers might have suggested Pryor, but there was never any ripple that Moranis and I were supposed to be in Trading Places, mm-hmm. and we couldn't because we were doing SCTV.
Right.
So maybe that's where it came from, because they're both Landis movies. You know, and sometimes that kind of stuff just crosses. People are really sloppy with their stories, especially today. Man, there's so much misinformation going on. You go on sites like Quora and Reddit and things like that, and they're just like, people are just lying their faces off. It's ridiculous. So
I always say, check your sources. You know, you got to cite it.
Oh, yeah,
you
absolutely.
Cite something.
And then
you can't just come out with nonsense. This is why we do interviews, because at least you were there. You could tell us the truth. Or your perspective of the truth, at least, anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's all it would be, too.
And I would love to know a little bit just about the dynamic you have with Dan Aykroyd when you're writing, like what your process is, and also about this trip to Goldeneye that you two took.
Oh, you know about that.
Mm.
Well, let's start there. So I get a call from Dan, and he says, we can finish our writing. So we were still working on the UFO movie at that time. He had just finished Neighbors with Belushi. And I had just finished an NBC cycle for SCTV. So he said, can you meet me in Jamaica? He said, I'll pick you up at the airport. And he said, I got a house. You'll have your own bedroom thing. We got maids and everything. All right. So I went down there and he picked me up at the airport. And all I can remember is we get in the car and the first thing he does is he gives me this like gigantic split to start smoking. And then he tears down this road. It's the narrowest road I've ever seen in my life, with, you know, buses, jitney buses and other things are coming and straight at you. And he's going as fast as possible down this road to get to the house. And I thought, well, I'm going to be dead before I get to the house. I'm not going to get to see this legendary, celebrated home of the creator of the Bond movies. But anyway, we get there, and it was pretty interesting. There was a guy named Darcy who rolled the splits for us. And there were two women that prepared and cleaned, and they were just there. They lived on the property. And the house was owned by Chris Blackwell's mother, who was the Island Records guy. You remember who he was? And
the name rings a bell, yeah.
He owned Island Records, which was driven by Bob Marley. That was their big client. And one of the days we went to her place for tea. So we had tea with Chris Blackwell's mum in her beachside place. And so how are you enjoying GoldenEye? And I said, well, it's lovely, you know, and we're well taken care of. And we didn't know whether to mention the splits or not, you know, but that house was right on a bay. And they had what Danny used to call the trench. And we would go in that and swim around for a while and then come back and start writing. And then Danny got calls from Belushi because Neighbors opened and it didn't open well. And this is a movie where Belushi had decided, I don't want to be the weird comedy guy shoving mashed potatoes in my mouth anymore. You could be the crazy guy, Dan. I'm going to be the straight guy. Because he desperately wanted to be seen as a leading man. And I don't know, I never understood that. There's a thing that a lot of comedians go through. When you become popular, a lot of comedians confuse that with handsome. And it's not true. You still look the same. But because you're popular now, women treat you differently and you get a good table when you go to a restaurant. You start to think that you're James Bond and you're not. So I saw a little of that when John was doing Continental Divide. And I thought, man, you're this short Albanian comic. I don't know. You don't have any mirrors at your place. I know what I look like, you know. And it's really true that when you're on television, all of a sudden doors open for you that didn't before. And so I can see how people would make that mistake, but I think keeping your perspective is the hardest and the most important thing to do in the business. But so Belushi starts dumping on Danny for his choice of playing the straight guy, saying that he never should have listened to Dan and he should have played the comedy character and that would have made the movie work. Well, I don't think it would have. I just think it was a weird movie. And, you know, what makes a movie connect on an opening weekend is like anybody's guess. You know, you got 3 days to make it. And if you don't, then, you know, you get sidelined by the studios. And I went through that with The Expert. So I know exactly what it's like, you know, when your movie doesn't live up to the studio's expectations. And it's odd because prior to Animal House, no comedy had ever made $100 million. And then all of a sudden, Animal House, now studios expected all their comedies to make $100 million. And if they didn't, they were considered failures. And by the way, the budgets did not escalate to 50, 70, 80 million. The budgets for comedies were still in the, you know, $5 to $10 million range, with some of the bigger, more outrageous ones like Blues Brothers and some of the Landis things getting, you know, more money. But basically speaking, the studio expectations was what rose. So anyway, I don't know what Neighbors did its opening weekend. You can look that up on Box Office Mojo. But I have a memory of it being somewhere in the, you know, $10 to $18 million range or something like that, which is pretty good, you know. I don't think it costs that much. So that bummed Danny out, and that ruined our writing for that. So the rest of the trip was mainly, you know, talking Danny off the edge of a ledge over how Belushi had bummed him out because Neighbors hadn't opened, you know. And but I loved the house. And the part, it was a compound, so it was gated and walled off. And when you went out of the gate, there was so much poverty there. I I didn't know anything about the third world. I'm very isolated. And there's people with their hands out for cash, just for cash. And Danny had said, you got to take, he gave me a bunch of Jamaican, a bundle of Jamaican money. And he said, six of Jamaican dollars for every one US dollar. So just hand them out. It's money to keep them from tearing your clothes off. And so we would drive out to get some supplies and be handing money out as we did. And we were there for New Year's. It was over the Christmas break. And so we went to this place called Moxon's. And it was owned by this British guy, Oliver Moxon. And he had these signs like the signs I used to see when we lived in the U.S. South for Stuckey's, you know, as you go along U.S. Route 1 from North Carolina down to Florida. And there were signs like Moxley's, 10 miles, you know, Moxley's, reputedly the best. Moxley's, can't find a finer meal anywhere, you know, this kind of thing. So we get there, Moxon's. I would say Moxley's. And Oliver Moxon is maitre d'ing himself. And, you know, he might have recognized Dan or something, but anyway, he seated us in. But he was like a racist, complete lunatic, screaming abusively at all his black staff. And it was like really embarrassing. And we couldn't wait to get out of there. And not because it, just because it was embarrassing. It was the kind of stuff that would probably get him in jail today. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So that was where we spent New Year's Eve. Moxon's, reputedly the best. Reputedly the most racist restaurant I'd ever been in. And then I came home. And so we didn't finish writing. And then we had to meet up again in Palm Desert. And I met Dan. He said, rent a car. Take it. 10 San Bernardino and then go to Palm Desert. It's like near Palm Springs. And there's a place called the Two Bunch Palms. And so I'm driving along at night now. And then this is when it was, it's become a much bigger place now, but it was just a little place that had a hot tub, like a hot springs pool grotto. And I'm driving along. I'd called Danny from the airport and said, I don't know how long it'll take me, maybe a couple hours. And I'm driving along and I hear, David! And I screech to a stop. And I back up and Dan's standing on the side of the road in his underwear. Just a pair of white, you know, the other kind of briefs. And he says, come on, join me in the hot tub. So I was like, okay. So I pulled into the parking lot and then I said, well, where should I go to get? He said, just take your clothes off and put them in the car. And I said, I'm not going in the goddamn thing naked. It's mixed. And he said, no, we'll just have your underwear on. So I went in there, and he was with Rosie Schuster, who was Lorne Michaels' ex-wife. And so they were, like, there, and he was writing with me, and she was out shopping or something. And I don't know how she was spending her day. She's a writer, actually, so I don't mean to short sell her. Maybe she was writing something on her own. But then he got the flu. The worst, most violent flu of vomiting and diarrhea and he wanted to keep writing. And I wasn't going to go in the same hotel room as somebody that was that sick. Because when he threw up, it was violent. It was like, you know, the kind of stuff you would hear, you know, in a prison or something. So I had a chair in the doorway. This is ground level, and it was like open to, so I could see the parked cars behind me, and then Dan lying on bed in front of me. But we kept writing, and we finally finished the script. So that was Vilcabamba, and I thought it was a funny, it was a good idea. It was about a architect from San Francisco that inherits a farm, and he goes to sell it because he doesn't want to keep it. And when he goes to the farm, he finds this old guy living on the grounds, groundskeeper, who had worked with his grandfather, and he shows him this warehouse that's part of the property, and inside the warehouse is a UFO. And the government just built a, it's now marked property of the United States Air Force. There's jacks around it where they tried to jack it up and they couldn't lift it. So they just built a warehouse around it and then put an electric fence around that and threw away the key. And so these guys, he joins up with an accountant from a local, from the Air Force base nearby. And the two of them start tracing back the story. So it's kind of a Roswell type story, but different. And anyway, we almost got this going with Phil Alden Robinson, and then Spielberg went and ruined all our dreams for us. So.
It's funny that you go to the home of Ian Fleming where so many of his stories were created, and it's actually the sort of UFO story that comes out of that one. It's not Spies Like Us. You'd think that's where it comes from.
No, you're absolutely right. And Spies Like Us was written 100%, at least by us, by Danny and I, on the Universal lot. And I remember Hitchcock was still coming to the office
Oh, wow.
when we had that office. And so it was kind of weird. I remember seeing him a couple of times, but we didn't dare go up and introduce ourselves. And yeah, it was 100% written on the lot. I'm sorry I don't have more details. There
No, it's
there
fine.
was a tour, but it was really lame. Wasn't like it is today. They just took a group of people in a kind of a tram down to the old Mexican town and the Western town and a couple of street sets and then dropped them off. You know, that's all they saw. And there weren't any active production shooting on the lot except for that Continental Divide that was in a soundstage. I'm not giving you good enough stuff here,
This is fine. Also, just hearing that Alfred Hitchcock was somewhere near Spies Like Us being made is quite bizarre, I think, for spy movie fans,
Yeah.
because he could have just walked in and be like, "Hey, I'm the father of spy movies. Let's do a spy film." That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, he was around.
Well, you mentioned the sort of changeover with John and moving to Chevy, and it had those two the writers come in and do the sort of joke pass on the film. Like the bare bones of the story, was that the same for John and Chevy?
Yeah, that was basically the same.
It was just sort of just changed the jokes, basically, just more for Chevy's sense of humor, I suppose, then.
And more jokey.
Right.
We had more of the sort of man who would be king feel, which is just two guys in a foreign land that is so completely different and foreign than anything they know, wandering through steeps and steppes and in mountainous regions. And Central Asia is a really bizarre place to be walking around. And then to run into a Soviet train with a missile on it, and then, you know, some female missile staff, Russian female missile staff, I mean, that was all part of it. But and the recruitment, that was the same. But there was other stuff like Bob Hope playing through the. We didn't put that in, even though I'd impersonated Bob Hope on SCTV and done stuff with him. I think at that point, and I don't know. But we didn't put that. That wasn't in our draft. That was in the Gans and Mandel draft.
I'd read that there was like a fair amount of improvisation in the film when you're shooting. And I'd curious just about writing that when you're dealing with actors and, you know, comedians who are known to kind of riff a bit. Does that like, is that factored into when you're writing the screenplay?
No.
No.
Because there is much less of that riffing than you would think. When you're writing a screenplay, this is a blueprint for a production that a studio is financing. And they budget the thing on page count. Like, how many pages can we shoot a day?
Mm-hmm.
How big is the crew going to be? How many days are we going to need the crew for? And there's so much money attached to the calculating in this that they don't really want to hear about improv when they're looking at a script, because a four-line exchange could be 3 pages of improv back and forth. And that might not take as much time as you think, but when that gets broken down, if you add 3 or 4 pages to a script, your movies move pretty slowly. They're usually 2 pages a day, sometimes not even that. So then you're doubling, you're adding a day. And a day on a move, on a big movie, is, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you can't really do that. So there can be a little bit of improvising on your coverage in a take, you know, but generally speaking, there isn't a lot of room for improvising in film at all.
Right. And I'd love to know, you know, you said you weren't available to act in the film. Were you doing any on-set rewriting at all, or were you basically gone at that point?
I was gone.
Out the door.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't go on the set of that movie once. I was invited, but I was shooting, so I couldn't, you know? It was really funny, because everything was so busy back then. It was just like, okay, you do this, and then you got to do that, and then you got to do that. And then you got flight time in between the gigs, and then maybe a couple of days off here and there, or that Christmas break at GoldenEye we just talked about. But those are rare exceptions. It's mostly, for me, it was just mostly just going from gig to gig to gig, you know?
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Look alive, agents. We're here with important intel on how you can support the Spyhards podcast. See, we don't have Elector King bankrolling us, which is why the Spyhards Patreon is so crucial. But fear not, we have bonuses galore.
That's a bingo. Over on the Patreon, you can listen to our ever-expanding Agents in the Field library, where we review major movies from your favorite spy actors, plus our latest show, OSS, in which we dive into the world of cloak and dagger television, from Ian Fleming biopics to Le Carre miniseries and more. Now, Cam, tell the listeners about this week's top secret broadcast.
We're getting downright animated because we are going to tackle 2011's The Adventures of Tintin. Does Spielberg's adaptation of the beloved Hergé comic strips deliver? We'll investigate.
So strap on your Condor Man wings and soar into the future with us over at patreon.com/spyhards.
But before Big O zaps us with a red pulsating laser, let's get back to the spy jinx.
One bit of information about Spies Like Us that's sort of spoken about online is it having a bad test. And I know you weren't on set during production, but you're still part of the writing for that. And having to do reshoots and change the ending of the film, which happens a lot in Hollywood, still happens today. But do you have any sort of recollection of what the original ending was, or what maybe what it is that you wrote, at least anyway, and what, because obviously we know what it turned into, but it's not really known how the film ended originally.
Shit. Well, if I it's in storage now, but if I had the original drafts that Dan and I did, but I don't remember how it ended. I mean,
it's a lot darker, apparently. I think the missile is supposed to land and actually go off.
Yeah. 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 And Dan loves those darker endings. And I do too, actually, in all fairness. Here's another example. It's okay. Also, I was in Coneheads, which was a another Dan Aykroyd. And I played the ruler of the Conehead planet. Anyway, the way that movie ended was the Coneheads come back and conquer Earth. So Paramount tests it and it tanks. The testing does really badly. So I get a call from Bernie Brillstein. Dave, they need to do a reshoot of the ending of Coneheads. And I go, well, I'm up in Canada. I'm shooting another movie, right? I'm prepping. I was prepping to shoot a movie I was going to direct. I say, I can't do it. He said, Dave, you got to come down and do this. It's pressure. But and then I got a call from Lorne Michaels because he was the producer of Coneheads. And so they obviously wanted to shoot with me and the Conehead ruler because that's a contained set. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to go blow a bunch of money on all the extras and everything else. They just do the... me and Phil Hartman and Dan and a couple other people, and then they got it. Finally, I just said, okay, I'll do it for, if you give me some money and some good money to come down and do this, because it's a real inconvenience. I'm jeopardizing another film that I'm prepping right now. You can take some time off during prep, but it's not good because you've got crew people waiting, you know, with location vans trying to drive you to locations which you have to approve if you're directing and things like that. So it was bad. But I said I can only come for one day and it's gotta be a hard out. And I said, I'll give you the full day from 6 a.m. to midnight. That's a day and a half, really. I said, but I gotta be out by midnight because I gotta be on a plane. I gotta be back in Vancouver in the morning. And so I said, all right, yeah, we'll do that. And so they did that. And then when I told them how much money I wanted, they said, we got to run this by the studio. And then the president of Paramount sends a message to Bernie Brillstein saying, tell Thomas he's got the money, but he's never going to work at Paramount again. And I laughed because Bernie Brillstein had a saying they used to tell us. He said, you'll never work there again until they need you. And sure enough, two years later, I was back at Paramount shooting Rat Race. So, you know, but they reshoot endings a lot, especially in comedies, because if it's a dark comedy, sometimes you can't obviously end on a dark note. The most important things, moments in any movie are the opening where you kind of hook them in. Mm. And then leaving them with an up feeling when they leave so that they can recommend it to their friends, you know. So obviously it doesn't surprise me that they needed a new ending for Spies Like Us, you know. And I don't know what it was because I wasn't part of that. But anyway.
No, that's fair enough. Well, I think then we should pivot over to another film you did. The Experts, which we mentioned earlier very briefly, directorial, very different job comparing to writing a film. So how did The Experts come to you?
It came to me as a director for hire. I didn't write the script. The script was written by a guy named Nick Thiel, and I read it. I liked the idea of it. I thought, well, this could be funnier. There's a lot of places where this is not funny. And I said, I want to have the right to be able to rewrite some of this if it doesn't work on set, because I had a feeling it wouldn't, you know. And I inherited Travolta because I didn't cast him. That wasn't my idea. They said, this is a John Travolta movie. And I thought, well, all right. He's supposed to play a hipster. That's good. I like the idea of a little spy town in Russia that was modeled on an American town, and that's where they trained their spies.
Mm-hmm.
And then they bring in some couple of guys to update it, and they just update it too well. And they get this pesky little notion of freedom in the minds of the people in the Soviet Union. And then they decide they want to get out. And then the climax is them escaping. So that was the arc that we were going towards on it. I had done Strange Brew with Rick Moranis, which I co-directed with Rick. And then, mm-hmm. but Rick wasn't really involved in post at all. He left to go do Streets of Fire. That's what I mean about people just being moving on to their next thing.
Yeah.
So I edited Strange Brew by myself, but I had a producer named Jack Grossberg that we had hired. And he was one of these old lions of Hollywood who he knew the studio system really well. He'd started out as a first AD, and he'd been first AD on the Waterfront with Brando and The Harder They Fall with Bogart. And then he had produced Take the Money and Run, Bananas, and Sleeper for Woody Allen. And then he had produced big movies like Missouri Breaks and Hospital with George C. Scott. And they brought him in to do Back to the Future after they fired Eric Stoltz and put Michael J. Fox in. They were like a couple weeks behind, and they needed to get somebody who could bring it in on time and on budget. Jack Grossberg was the man, and I became good friends with him, and he was very director friendly. He protected directors, and he knew the business, and he knew the budgets and the crews, and had all these connections and relationships with the unions. Just the stuff that I didn't have, and that a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went into the experts, I said, I'm not doing this unless Jack Grossberg it comes into this and produces with me. And I got a message back from Paramount saying, Paramount, no directors tell Paramount who produces the movies. Paramount decides who produces the movies. I said, okay, well, then fine, get another director, because I'm not going to do it without Jack. I said, I'm not upset. That wasn't a negotiating ploy. I just don't want to do it without Jack.
Hmm.
So the head of Paramount at that time was Ned Cannon, and I'd known him from Universal. He was president when I was working on Spies Like Us. So he knew me, and he said, let him have Jack Grossberg. Who cares? So the head of production is kind of pissed off, the Paramount head of production. Because as it turns out, he's an old rival of Jack's. They came up as ADs together. So there's that kind of politics that you got to deal with in your job as a director, you know? So this is a bigger budget. This now it's up to $20 million or something like that. And you got to go in for this meeting with the studio and present your budget. And Jack and I went through the budget, and I said, well, how many days? I said, can we do this in this number of days? And Jack says, well, he says, I took a look at the script. He said, there's some paragraphs that you're going to have to rewrite. He said, there's a couple. He called them the little Kafka House of Horrors, where one paragraph in the middle of a script was actually 5 days of shooting. And so what read to the studio as a page was actually 6 pages. And so you had to be really careful in budgeting something like that, that you budgeted it correctly at 6 pages and not at 1. That's why I brought him in, because I would have screwed that up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he and the head of production of Paramount are screaming at each other at the budget meeting, where we're supposed to just come in, sign off on the budget. They're fighting. And I'm thinking to myself, oh man, what did I get myself into here? And I love Jack, but I don't want to get into a real adversarial situation with the studio. But anyway, we finally signed it, and then we went off to start shooting, prepping and shooting. And I met Travolta, and I'd never met him before. I didn't know anything about him other than, you know, Saturday Night Fever. And he was a really nice guy. And I thought, oh, well, he can do this. All right. And so we tried some people for his partner, and Ari Gross seemed to be the best chemistry and fit. So I had worked with Kelly Preston in a movie as an actor, where she was an actress. And I thought, well, she's this ridiculously hot woman that, you know, we went, here's an example of the effect that she had on men. We went to a Kids in the Hall opening on at the Roxy, and I went in with Kelly just because I knew her, and she comes, and there was some other guys with us and a couple of agents and things like that, and she sees these Kids in the Hall sweatshirts, and she goes, oh, those are so sweet. I would love one of those. And just like, wham, there's like five guys put their money on the counter to buy her a t-shirt. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
She could get anything she wanted. So I thought, well, maybe she can get Travolta. We'll see. And so they had a screen test together and had a real good chemistry. And so I thought, okay, I got that part solved. And now I just got to figure out how to deal with the Kafka House of Horrors. Jack put a DP on this, who had done Chorus Line and Gandhi, an English DP. I've gone blank on his name.
Ronnie Taylor.
Ronnie Taylor. God bless you. So Ronnie hated Knights. And he had said that he read the script and there weren't a lot of night shoots in it. So he said, I'll do it. And then Ned Tannen said he wanted a kind of a car rally scene. Ned's the president of Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
He wants a car rally scene like American Graffiti in the town as part of the dynamic. And that car rally scene we had to add into the script. And that added 5 days. And all of a sudden, we're behind. And that pushes stuff forward in the board. And we have to move some stuff to Knights. And the Knights are in Vancouver. And the car stuff was in Niagara-on-the-Lake in Ontario. So I'm thinking to myself, well, this is not going to be good because Ronnie Taylor hates Knights. And Jack got wind that Ronnie was going to quit from his agent. And Jack says to me, I know how to handle this. And I said, okay. So Jack goes up to Ronnie on the first night of Knights in Vancouver. And he says, I'll bet you $500 that we're out of here by midnight. And Ronnie's like, what are you talking about? He said, we got a full night's work here. We can't possibly be out of here by midnight. He says, we'll be lucky to get out by sunup. And he says, well, you want to take the bet or don't you? And he says, well, I don't want to just take your money unless you know something I don't know. And Jack says, you want to take the bet or don't you? I'll take the bet. So he takes the bet. And at midnight, Jack comes up to him, hands him $500 in cash and a bottle of scotch. And Ronnie laughs. And Jack did that every night that we're doing Nights.
Wow.
And I said to him at the end of the week, I said, that's $2,500. And Jack says, if I'd gone to his agent and offered him an extra $2,500 a week, he would have passed. He said, but you give it to him as brown bag money with a joke and some bottles of scotch. And he said, you got him. That's how smart this guy was. And he did stuff like that all the time. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You understand, he would make deals where you would think you're out of money. And at one point, the studio was going through some changes and there was a new guy that came in. Gary Lucchese came in as president. Now, Ned Tanen was still the boss, but Gary was a new president. And they found out that we had got 5 days behind because of that car thing that Ned had had. And so they said, you're a week behind. That means you're $1 million short. And Jack says, I got the money. Jack Roseberg, the producer, I got the money. He says, you can't have the money. You signed a budget that said you need this many days, and now you're 5 days over. You can't possibly have the money. Jack says, I got the money. What can I fucking tell you? I made some deals. So they send up a team. They say, Gary and another producer comes up, and two accountants to go to the offices, the production offices, and go through the books and see if Jack does have the money or not. And the other guys come to me with suggestions of where to cut the script. Mm-hmm. So we're in my trailer, and you're saying, well, we cut this scene here. And I look at it and I go, well, if you're going to cut that scene, then you got to cut this scene and this scene because they're interlinked. Oh, well, this scene could go. And I said, well, if you're going to take that scene out, you got to change the ending because of this and this. And they go, oh. So Jack was right. This guy, Nick Thiel, had written a Kafka House of Horrors, not just in some pages with paragraphs that were more shooting than they looked like, but in the whole script and the way it was interweaved and interlocked. So, and we had to do a lot of rewriting on set. You know, I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But anyway, this story ends as the accountants come out. The executives can't cut any of the script and are pissed off about that. The accountants come out and they throw their arms up and they go, he's got the money. And they go, what? How can he have the money? And they're going to look like schmucks. They're going to go back to Paramount and they go, what he said was true. He had the money and we can't cut the script. And so they get in the car and they're ready to go. And the head of production's name is Roger Rothstein. And Jack says, they get in the car and they roll down the window to say goodbye. He says, have a safe trip back, fellas. Hey, tell that schmuck Rothstein. He says, tell him, don't come back. Because if you do, you'll be $1 million over and you won't know where the fuck it came from. And he slammed the roof of the car and he walked off. I'm left standing there as these studio execs are just fuming and drive off with the accountants to go back to L.A. Anyway, a lot of the stuff didn't work. And we put it on its feet. And I got to hand it to Travolta. He had good taste. He had a good sense of what would work and what wouldn't work. And some stuff that is in the movie still doesn't work, admittedly. But most of the bad stuff we fixed. And we put it on its feet. And it would just be a turd. And we'd go, oh, God. And everyone would know it, you know, and Ari Gross would be like, oh, God. And John is like, all right. John's very positive. All right, we can fix this. And I go to Ronnie Taylor. I go, what do you think? And he said, well, from the way you blocked it, he said, I could do a soft lighting and then get it all pointed this way and then just get some keys when we get the particulars and, you know. He said, give me 2 hours, and I'll have the whole thing lit, and then we can move fast. So that gives us 2.5 hours to rewrite. So we go back to Travolta's trailer, and we rewrite. And we would bring it, we'd test it in the trailer, and read it, and if it made us laugh, that's good. But it was hard work, because, you know, you got to be there early to do your shoot, and then you got to go into a rewriting session before you shoot, and then you got to shoot and make up for the time that you could have spent rehearsing or shooting earlier. It was challenging, I got to say. But I don't know. I was pleasantly surprised with Travolta. And you know, Paramount threw that film away, mm-hmm, at the end because they tested it. And they recruit audiences for testing, and they couldn't recruit. John had done a couple of unpopular movies just before this. I forget what they were called, but they had, Look Who's Talking hadn't come out yet. That was after The Experts. So this is kind of at the bottom of John's career. And John had, you know, with Saturday Night Fever and Grease, and he'd made $1 billion for Paramount, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was hoping the studio would be behind him, and they weren't behind him at all. And he was devastated by that because, you know, the lack of loyalty and just the, you know, sort of dog-eat-dog nature of it was just terrible. And I remember feeling worse for him than for myself, even though I knew I was pretty much finished as a director. if this thing goes the way I think it's going to go. And then Ned Tanen gets booted out. That's the worst thing that can happen to you when you have a movie opening, is the guy who approved it leaves.
Right.
It's like this guy named Sid Gannis comes in. He's the new head. And he said he wanted to see me. So I go over to his office and he says, Dave, we're going to platform release The Experts. And I said, oh, yeah. What does that mean? He said, well we're going to take it to a couple of smaller markets in Texas where John's last movie opened well. And if it does well, then we'll go wider with it. And I said, I see. So I said, can I ask you a question? He said, yeah. I said, if you're going to be testing this in markets where John's last movie did well and The Experts does well in that same market, what will you know that you don't already know about that market? And he goes, yeah, it doesn't work that way. Look, I have another meeting. So he basically just fuck off, get out of here. So I knew at that point that they were going to throw it away, and they did. And then Travolta flew to the opening on his own plane, his Hawker 125. I flew in that with him a few times. And he flew Kelly and Ari to the opening, and they attended it. And it was sad. It was terrible that they threw it away like that. So it made all the money that it made in video, you know what I mean? In home video, because I think it only opened in 2 or 3 theaters. It's like that's the game that studios play. What a lot of people don't realize about movies is when your movie has a $20 million budget or a $100 million budget, that's just the production budget. Then there's the so-called marketing of the movie. And this is where the studios can do that shell game where all profits get hidden, you know, and they do that. And so they'll cross collateralize movies that do well with movies that didn't do well. Mm-hmm. And then they've got the exhibitors and everybody in their hip pocket, you know what I mean? They can just say, report this way and report this that way. And then they can send those sheets out to the profit participants and say, sorry, it's still in the red. Mm-hmm. You know, we still haven't made the money back. It's really hard to quantify unless you do media buys for a living, what the studio might have spent in promoting and advertising a movie, you know? So that's the sort of stuff behind the scenes of it. I had a great time with John, and John flew me up in his private jet from LA. So I got to go down and spend time with my family and then come back up to the set. Because he could do a turnaround like that, you know, he's a really good pilot, and I felt safe with him, and And the cast was just a nice, sweet group of people. And we forged our way through this. I hired Bill Murray's brother as Brian, who's a friend of mine, and he worked on SCTV with me. And Jack Grossberg came to me and he said, "We're going to drop and carry Brian." And that means when they make a deal for you for a film, if they're going to carry you for the whole film, that means they haven't boarded it out thoroughly yet. And they don't know exactly what dates they need mm-hmm. you. So they're going to block you out for all the dates. And then they got to pay you for all those dates.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they don't want to do that if they can get away with it. So Jack had boarded it out now. And he knew he could block and he could drop and carry Brian. I said, "I want to drop and carry him." He said, "What?" I said, "I need him." I said, "I might need him." I made this up. I just said, "I might need him on days that I don't know. I could put him in some other scenes." And Jack just looks at me. He goes, "He's your buddy, isn't he?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Okay, we'll carry him. We'll carry him for the whole show." So, you know, there was another comedian on that in the cast, Rick Dukeman, who one night took everybody to a comedy club and got Travolta to get up on stage in front of everybody. And this guy, Dukeman, was an accomplished stand-up. So being a stand-up is its own little thing, you know? It's like these guys typically, before they really hit it, they've all spent 10 years on the road in sort of different horrible little venues. And so anyway, Rick was kind of a very dark, kind of a hard-ass guy. He got Travolta up on the stage and he embarrassed him. And John was just good-natured about it, handled it really well. Because he was this sort of bulletproof matinee idol, he handled it. But I heard about it from some of the crew the next day and I was really pissed off at Dukeman. Because it's like, come on, man, you were supposed to be a family here.
Mm.
And you're taking our lead and you're trying to like show you're better as a stand-up. We know you're a stand-up. Don't be an ass. So anyway, I come to the set after hearing this and I'm really mad. And I said, where's Dukeman? They said, he's in Travolta's trailer. And that's another thing. Like, what? You're like sitting in Travolta? Because Travolta was just this nice guy. If you came to his trailer, he wouldn't kick you out.
Mm, yeah.
But it was like, there's a sense of decorum where you gotta be respectful on the set, you know. Anyway, I walk into Travolta's trailer and I just see Dukeman right away. I said, "Pack up your stuff and get the fuck out of here." He said, "What?" He said, "I'm in stuff today." I said, "Not anymore, you know. I just wrote you out." I said, "What you did last night sucks." And I said, "You can't do that. We're supposed to be a family here. And that just tells me you're not a team player. And so team players, I don't want them around." I said, "If I need you in other scenes that I got to have you, I'll let you know. But for now, you're on hold. Go home." And so I didn't even know Travolta was in the trailer. I thought Dukeman was inside his trailer, but because I was like looking at this end of the trailer. And then I turn around and I see John, and John's just sitting there like this, you know. And I said, "Oh, well, John, I'm sorry that you had to see that." And John just smiled. He said, "No, I respect strength in the director. It's fine." And I said, "All right." So I left. And so, you know, there's stuff that goes on sets that isn't on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an iceberg. And there's this stuff that the audience sees. And then there's all this other shit that goes on, you know, that is part of the making of the movie that that you don't know about, you know. And James Keach, for example, was the producer of the movie, and he's an actor. And he wanted to be the co-star with Travolta. Well, he's not the right look, and he's not a comedian. He's not funny. That's the main thing, is he's not funny. Ari Gross is funny. So I remember I came to the office during pre-production And his secretary said, James needs to see you in his office. And I was like, all right. So I went to his office, and he's sitting there in his office, and he goes, what's the meaning of this? And he hands me the trades. It's like the Hollywood Reporter. And I said, it says, Keach co-stars with Travolta in upcoming Experts. He said, did you release this to the trades? I said, you have to be the stupidest person I've ever met. I said, I would never release this to the trades because I don't want you in that part. And I said, the only person who would release this to the trades is you. And guess who's going to figure that out before you get to lunch today? Ned Tannen. You're going to be in Ned's office before lunch today. But 9:30, he gets a call from Ned. Get the hell over here. Because Ned knew, you know, that he had done that. So then he comes to me and he says, well, I decided that the role of producer is a big job, and that part would have been too big for me. So instead, now I want to play the role of Mr. Smith. And I had already earmarked Charles Martin Smith for that role. He's a good actor. He was in The Untouchables. Mm-hmm. He's done a lot of movies. And he could handle, he was the right look. And so now I'm pissing. And so I go over to Ned's office and I said, okay, thanks for chewing him out for putting that thing in the trades. But now he wants to play the role of Mr. Smith in the movie. And Ned says, well, who do you want to be in the role? And I said, I want Charlie Martin Smith. And Ned goes, oh yeah, I like him. He's a good actor. And I said, okay. So what's it? Ned says, just go. I'll take care of it. I said, what are you going to? He said, just go. I'll take care of it. So then the next day, I come into the office, and Keach's secretary says, Jim wants to see you in his office. It's like, oh, God. So I go in his office, and all the shades are drawn now. He's just sitting in there in the dark. And he says, you know, I've been thinking more about this, and I realized that the role of Mr. Smith is a big role, and the role of producer is a big job, and it's going to pull me away from my job as producer. And I said, well, I'm trying to be nice, you know, and I'm saying, well, that's a big decision, and I think a wise one, because it is true. The job of producer is a big job. And so he said, so now he said, I want to play Yuri. So he says, I said, what? I had somebody else in mind for Yuri. So now I go back to Ned. And I said, now he wants to play Yuri. And Ned said, so let him play Yuri. I don't give a fuck. He said, listen. He says, the producer of the movie, he said, he obviously wants to be in it. You hate him. He says, I don't hate him, but I don't care about him. He said, let him be Yuri. I don't care. So I said, all right, he's going to be Yuri. So I knew that James wore a toupee because he had been in this movie with Bill Murray. And Brian had been, Brian, Bill's brother, had been with him in France when he bought this really expensive toupee. It was like $3,000, which back then was a lot for a hairpiece. And so I said to him, so you want to be Yuri? I said, well, just grow your hair out and make it get a brush cut, because I Yuri's this Russian pilot and he should have a brush cut. And then I just walked out and left him with that dilemma. And to his credit, he goes out and pays a wig maker in LA to make him a brush cut hairpiece. And it was a really good looking hair. I couldn't fault it. So I was like,
I had no idea. I had no idea when I watched it earlier.
Me neither.
That it was a wig. You got me there.
Yeah. Mm. It's a wig. It's a wig. Yeah. And I added that thing with him on the plane, jumping up and down on the ailerons to loosen them. And he said to me, he said, I want to do my own stunt there. And I said, it's all right with me. And Grossberg says to me, are you out of your fucking mind? I said, what do you mean? He said, I know you don't like this guy. He said, but you're trying to kill him now. You're trying to put him on the wing of a moving DC six and jump up and down on the ailerons. I said, he's going to be roped. He's going to have a safety harness. And Jack says, I'm not going to allow it. And finally, he got in the thing. And then Keach did actually get on the wing for some of it and do some of it himself. So there's these kind of dramas that, you know, that go on behind the scenes in movies. We shot that little town in Niagara-on-the-Lake because it looked like a Norman Rockwell 50s town. Mm-hmm. And the only part that was really hard was the car stuff. But we ended up cutting a lot of it because it just was a stupid add-on that the president of the studio made us add in, you know? And it was, by then I was like, you know, it was hard to get the shots and the budget for the airplane stuff at the end. That was challenging. And I found that difficult, but I also found out during the experts that's not the kind of movie I should direct. I don't like directing that kind of movie. I don't mind a comedy movie like that's set in a hospital or set in a location where it's mainly talking heads and, you know, I can concentrate on getting the dialogue and the comedy right. I think I can bring that kind of a contribution to a movie. But a movie that's about action sequences and shooting guns and says stuff like that's not me. That's not what I do well. And so you're allowed in Hollywood if you get on enough of a run to kind of fail up and then find your own level, you know. And so that was what that was for me. I was done with directing after that for a while. I didn't go near anything.
Well, the only question I had left about The Experts is, and you mentioned that sort of Paramount shelved it after that sort of mini release out there, and it was put out on home video. But it was recently restored and put out by the fine folks at Kino Lorber. There, it has its own Blu-ray and everything now. So just your thoughts on, you know, looking back on the film, I'm sure maybe you revisited it when that re-release came out. What sort of moments you're proud of with the film that you put together?
I'm proud of some of the stuff that John did that's funny. I thought he was funny in that. You know, there was some stupid stuff we added where, you know, John was like at home watching cartoons and it was just, he was laughing at the cartoons and, you know, and I was pleased with the dynamic with him and Kelly and the fact that that worked out. And the dance number, I wasn't happy with the music because the music that I wanted, we couldn't afford.
Right.
And in post-production, if you're on the short end of the stick with the studio, that's where they'll make the cuts. And so they didn't pay for any of the kind of songs that would have helped driven this thing in the nightclub and given us something better to cut to and something better to shoot. So that couldn't be fixed with the music that we had, you know. And music was in a transition then too, where DJs were just starting. And Keach was the producer and he found this DJ and I listened to this stuff and I think it was great, you know. And I was looking for stuff that I could do with John and Kelly that that built their romantic relationship, you know, and then stuff that built that what a nice guy John was. There was a sequence with John where he's walking with Ari and Ari is saying something about, he split up with his girlfriend and John says, well, I didn't like her. She was not much anyway. And he goes, wait, you told me you loved her. And now you're telling me you don't like her? And John just looks at me. He says, hey, you like her? I like her. You hate her? I hate her. That's what friends are all about. You know, something like that. And I was pleased with the way they played that and pleased with that kind of dynamic. What did you guys like about it? Obviously, you watched it. Did you like it or not? And you can be honest with me because I can hear it.
We spend our lives watching spy films, so analyzing it was sort of something we do best, I'd say. And I agree with what you said, actually. I think the premise was the best part. I think the idea of this sort of like Russian sleeper town where you train agents is very much like the... I don't know if you ever saw the River Phoenix film, Little Nikita, came out the year before, 88. And that's like kind of like... It's almost like the flip reverse of that, where it's the Russian sleeper agents in an American town. And they're activated the other way around. And so it's a nice twist on its head of that. And I really like the premise. And I think John Travolta's, well, it's John Travolta. You put him in a film, there's good. He's got that, you said matinee idol, it's that leading man charisma. So I think you've got all that going for it. And I think, I also just think it was funny at times. And I think that comes from you having Dave Thomas at the helm of your film. It's going to have some comedy in there. So you brought that too.
Well, you know what John told me when he found out they weren't going to release it? He said, I told you he was heartbroken because he had made that studio over $1 billion and he expected some loyalty from Paramount. And I said, well, I said, I have a manager, Bernie Brillstein, who says, never be loyal to a logo because it won't be loyal to you. And Travolta laughed and he said, well, if I ever get in the position to make big money again, he said, I'm just going to bank it. I'm going to bank it all. I am going to take as much as I can get for it. So three of his big movies, and I called him and said, good for you, buddy. I'm with you. Sock it to them. Get every nickel you can get out of those sons of bitches. Do you know what I mean?
The movie I kept thinking about while I was watching it was The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming.
Oh, yeah.
And that sort of like culture clash comedy that you had going. And yeah, I agree with Scott. Like the concept I thought was really fun. And was that a movie you were even thinking about when you were making it, or was that just totally...
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit?
Yeah. I did remember that movie. But it is the reverse of that. You know, it is the hush, 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 we are the Russians, my dear. But it's also so long ago, too. My God. That's the other part of it that's really hard to... picture myself back there and reimagine what it was like.
Well, maybe something that's a bit more recent then. When I was going through your filmography, I realized that I'd seen you in something far more recently that's spy-ish, and that is Mitch Hurwitz's Arrested Development.
Yeah.
Which I'd completely forgotten all of the Bond puns, the For British Eyes Only, all that sort of stuff. And I went back and rewatched it. And I mean, kudos to you for your British accent, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, that was, my parents are Brits. So, you know, I'm a stickler on it. I tried to help Charlize with hers because she was just, stumbling through it, you know, that you could tell that. Mm. But she was such a good actress. And there was a scene we did in the house where I thought it was a throwaway scene because it was just the two of us. And I knew enough about television comedy that anytime you have two guest stars in the scene, that's possible cutting room floor fodder because, you know, if one of the principal cast isn't in the scene with you, then it's not furthering the action of the story or the action of the series. And so it was just two of us. But I learned my lines really thoroughly for that. And then I just threw away the rehearsal. And trying to fake Charlize out, you know, just to see what she would do. Mm. And then when we went for a take, I came at her really fast and hard with all my cues. I just like knew it, was on it. And she was right there matching me move for move and topping me in places. And I started improvising because I thought, well, let's see if you can do this, you know. And I mimed a bunch of locks on the door, and then she went and unlocked them. And in the same sequence that and I was looking, I was going, ooh, aren't you? So we finished that scene, and she just looked at me and she said, that was fun. And I said, yeah, it was. And then Mitch and Jimmy Valley came running down from the writer's office. They've been watching it on the feed, and they said, that was fucking great. That was a great scene. That was great. We love that scene. And we just got a couple of notes. We want you to do it again. So it was gratifying that a scene that we both thought was just cannon fodder, and but that we did and ended up doing a good job on that, that got in, you know. And she was just a delight to work with, and you know, just somebody who, when I met her, I wanted to make her laugh. And so somebody introduced, one of the PAs or somebody introduced, Dave, this is Charlize. And I looked at her and went, oh my God. And she looks at me, she goes, what? And I said, I thought you were beautiful and monster, but this is ridiculous. And she laughed at that. And so then I at least had her on my side, you know, from day one. And yeah, it was fun. And my favorite scene in that is smoking while brushing my teeth.
Yeah.
You're smoking practically the entire time, especially when you're chasing Jason Bateman. You get to drive a little Sportster as well, I think, at one point, with a nice little car. That was nice. Yeah, right. That was nice.
A little MG, yeah.
Did you know the arc of where that story was going to go, or were you finding out as it went along?
Finding it out. Those guys are up there. It was really funny, you know, because I was, Mitch comes down, he goes, really proudly, he says, we got, you know, 28 different locations in a 22-minute show. I said, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to get canceled? I said, that costs a lot of money. I said, why are you writing it like that? He said, because we can. And I went, all right, well, you know. But it's weird, you know, to see somebody do that, because I just don't think that way. I come from such cheapskate background in, you know, film and television, where I just try to write as inexpensively as possible, you know, and I'm trying to consolidate stuff into one location if I can.
Well, Dave, I think I could probably wax poetically about Arrested Development with you some more, but we've had you for a long time, so I'm going to leave you with the final question that we ask every single person that's ever come on this show. And considering you've been to the GoldenEye Resort, I have an idea where this might go, but I could be surprised. Dave Thomas, what is your favorite spy movie of all time?
3 Days of the Condor.
Boom. Great pick.
What an answer.
Didn't take me long, did it?
It did not.
No.
And you didn't go Bond.
No, and there's often hemming and hawing. No.
Tell you why. There is a line in that. There's several lines in that movie. But there was a line in that movie where John Houseman and what's his name? Cliff Robertson are talking. And Cliff asked John, because John Houseman goes back to the old OSS days. And Cliff Robertson says, do you ever miss those old days? And Houseman says, no, I miss the clarity. And it was like, that was like a real crystallization of where things have gone in spycraft, because there was a clear-cut enemy back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, Adolf Hitler and, you know, the emperor in Japan. And it was, but it was mainly Hitler. And so you knew who you were up against, and you knew who you could draw, align your forces, and you knew where the morality of what you're doing was. And you weren't second guessing yourself. And then it just got so messy after that. And so I love that scene at the end, because I worked with Von Sydow. He was in Strange Brew.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, when I met him in Strange Brew, I said, I know everything you've ever done. I've seen all your Bergman movies. I said, I knew you were, I know you're the first Jesus to ever show his face on screen. And I said, I memorized your last speech in 3 days of the Condor. And he, Von Sydow looks at me and goes, really? Well, can you do it for me now? And so I said, okay. So I started this, you know, it will happen like this, you know, where he's telling Redford what to expect, that it'll be a sunny day, a spring day, and a car will pull up and someone, you know, will get out. And he would leave open the door, you know, and then he stopped, Boncino stopped me there and he said, that was my idea. And I said, I was thinking, what, leaving the door open? He goes, no, no. He said, the European way of saying it was leave open the door. And I went, I was so disappointed. I was like, wait, that was just, your idea was just like a linguistic thing of like inverting the order? I said, no, no, the real thing there is that they'll leave the door open, you know. And Redford is looking down when he says he will leave open the door. Redford looks up at him right away. And it was just all the little things like that that he noticed in that movie that made it tick. I love that movie so much, you know. I thought it was really well done.
I can't think of a better pick, and I can't think of a better couple of hours spent than it was with you with Dave just now. Thank you for your time. Thank you for taking us through Spies Like Us, through The Experts, and thank you for those films. Thank you for your work. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you.
There you go, folks. That was our chat with Mr. Dave Thomas himself, a comedy legend here on the show. I can't quite believe it. Cam, what did you think?
This was a real treat. Being Canadian myself, Dave Thomas cast a very large shadow just because of his work of SCTV and Strange Brew. So this was kind of like one of those surreal moments. And then throw in things like Arrested Development and, you know, so many of his other projects. And it's kind of like, how did this happen? But in terms of Spies Like Us, I thought it was so interesting to, like we like to do on this show, set the record straight about things that, when I'm doing the research, are a little fuzzy. And so, first up, just him talking about who he was writing the film for. Because when we were doing the research, we were finding things like Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas could potentially star in the film. We found things about Richard Pryor and that he was able to shoot these rumors down and say exactly what the process was in terms of who was going to be starring in the film was just fantastic to have. I'm so happy we can, you know, have that finally updated. People, please jump on Wikipedia and correct that information. Mm-hmm. And then also, just the story of the legendary Goldeneye trip with Dan Aykroyd that I brought up on the show. And he gave us the proper context for it and gave us so many crazy stories about a trip to Goldeneye.
As I said to Dave, I'm shocked to hear that his spy film that he co-wrote has nothing to do with his trip to Goldeneye. That's a fascinating find in itself.
What a twist.
What a twist. It's a good spy twist, I'll say that.
Oh yeah, it's a fantastic one. I really didn't see it coming.
I didn't at all. We can update that on the Wikipedia page as well, or certainly on the IMDb trivia. So by all means, folks, go and get that changed. But also to find out that he immediately went home and was flagged down on the side of the road by Dan Aykroyd in his pants. That's the sort of stuff you won't hear anywhere else, folks.
That's why you come to Spy Hards.
Dan Aykroyd in his pants.
That's right.
And on the flip side of that, I mean, it only came to our attention doing the research for this interview. Some of the other wonderful things that Dave has been involved with when it comes to espionage in film. That's how we found The Experts and watched it in preparation for this. So it was great to sort of, yeah, because this has happened before a couple of times. I think back to the Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenée conversation where we had them on to talk about Never Say Never Again. But Dick Clement had directed two spy films himself, so we took a little bit of an opportunity to speak about those two. And, you know, we'll look at their films down the line, and also we'll look at The Experts at some point down the line as well. So we can almost point back to this as sort of a reference point where we spoke to the director of the film. And for me, it was just great to hear sort of some of the behind the scenes. I mean, Dave called it the iceberg of making films. What you see, it's basically the film and then everything else is underneath. And that's really what we do try to do here on the Spy Master Interviews, is bring you the rest of the iceberg.
Yeah, and it's always great too when you have movies that maybe aren't as well remembered as Spies Like Us,
to have these stories out there, because mm-hmm. there's people out there who caught the experts, whether it was on TV or video. They've seen the movie. It's in the back of their head somewhere. And to have these stories out there, I think, is a lot of fun. And I will say, though, Scott, to our credit, the experts was on our master list to cover in the future on Spy Hearts already. But we knew it more so as a John Travolta film. It popped up, I'm sure, somewhere when I was Googling spy films. The Dave Thomas connection, though, was the surprise. And I'm so thankful that we stumbled across it, because it allowed us to, you know, get these stories out there now.
Absolutely. It's one of the true joys of doing the Spy Master interviews. Obviously, getting to speak to the people is the first joy. But just to sort of flesh out some of these lesser-known spy stories is exactly what our show can do. It's proof of the concept.
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect way of putting it, yeah.
So yeah, I just want to thank Dave again for taking the time to speak with us. I hope you all enjoyed this conversation to learn a little bit more about spies like us, learn a little bit more about comedy history with Dave Thomas. But Cam, as always, the question goes to you, sir. What are we talking about next week?
Hop on the YouTube, folks, because we have a Spy Hard special. We are going to look at 1940s British Intelligence, a World War I thriller starring Boris Karloff.
Yeah, and it's also only 60 minutes. So 60 minutes well spent on YouTube, I would say. That's your weekend revision set up right there. And so your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to join us as we head back to 1940 with Boris Karloff and take a look at British intelligence, something I severely lack. And if you like what you heard on this episode, please consider supporting us over on Patreon, patreon.com/spyhards. I'll say it again, patreon.com/spyhards. There's a link in the show notes below. Very affordable price points. We're saving up to put a website together for yourselves, and it just helps keep the lights on here at Spy Hards HQ, because feeding those piranhas ain't cheap, I do tell you that, folks. Make sure you follow us discreetly on social media at Spy Hards. That's SPYHARDS on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But until next week, listeners, should you need me, you'll find me at the side of the road in just my briefs, flagging down traffic.